Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, listeners. Tim Silvey here. Today, I'm delighted to say that I'm back with the dog-loving designer, photographer, podcaster, influencer, content creator and YouTube giant and all-round good guy, Tom McCluskey. Tomo, how are you?
Photographer, I like, have you been following my Instagram shenanigans? Because I was on holiday, I was in Marrakesh last week and it's very photogenic. It made it easy for me to take lovely images then.
Well, do you know what? I actually looked at your website, which I've never looked at before, and it had it on there. I was very impressed, very impressed. Do you have the time to do that though, professionally?
No, that was in a past life. That made my, because the camera I use for my videos was my old photography camera that I used for e-commerce photography. So it kind of helped to have a nice camera for that. So it used to pay the bills, then it didn't, and now it kind of is again. So gone full circle. Good.
And you went to F1 Arcade, didn't you, to do a live show? How was that?
It was very good. Have you been, by the way?
No, not yet. I think I'm going to go next week on Wednesday.
Ooh. Okay, yeah. No, it's a really cool venue. Did a live show with Adas. Went down really well. Everyone seemed happy. It's very very expensive behind the bar. So I think there's like the most expensive cocktail is about 17 quid. So it's...
bloody hell.
But you can get beer on tap, house wine for about 6 quid. So it's about London prices in that. But you can spend a lot of money if you want.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go down there. I messaged Aldas the other day, actually, when I was looking for a co-host, because you couldn't do it and Harry couldn't do it and various other people couldn't do it, and he didn't bloody reply.
Wow. Bastard. Fooled.
Ghosted by Aldas. Anyway, shall I introduce today's guest?
Let's do it, buddy.
So today, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Tom Gaymore, a man of many talents who started out behind the wheel before turning his attention to behind the camera. He's a broadcaster who's equally at home commentating on Formula One as he is IndyCar or interviewing the biggest names in our sport. If you work in the industry, you're well aware of Tom's influence. And if you're a fan, you've no doubt heard his dulcet tones coming through your telebox. If this is your first time hearing from Tom, sit back and enjoy while we talk about his life, career, thoughts and opinions. Tom Gaymore, a very warm welcome to the Motormouth podcast. How are you?
Quite the welcome, Tim. Thank you very much. Yes, I'm intrigued to know more about Tomo's love for dogs, because I went to Crofts last week for the first time in my life and it was an interesting experience. I've never seen so many dogs. I've never seen so many dog lovers in one building, and it's big business, 5 halls as well. So if you've never been to Crofts, I suggest you go. Have you ever been?
No, never been. Never been. Oh, did you commentate over the dogs then? Were they like racing and you were given the old like, oh, through on the inside goes Bernard?
And we're off the assault course, over the bridge, the hurdles next.
You know what? So I've got a sausage dog, like a dachshund. And he's actually surprisingly, like, he could jump on the table from like the floor because he's got slightly longer legs. So I reckon he'd do well at Crofts. You've got a dog now, Tim, haven't you, as well?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Pippin. She's actually ventured out today for the first time to meet her brother, because our friends have bought her brother. So they met up and don't think they recognized each other because they fought. So that went well, but I've had her on the lead outside the house for the first time today, so we're getting into it. Dog ownership is good.
Excellent.
Tom, do you have a dog?
I've not got a dog yet, but the other half My wife is very keen on her dogs, so I'm sure it's not long.
You'll break that down one day. I mean, I was the resistant parent, and then eventually the wife convinced me otherwise. And it looks like, based off your background, there's a lovely garden there for a dog to run around. Where are you joining us from today?
So Tom? I am in the leafy suburbs of southwest London. So if you know your history, Hampton Court Palace is a stone's throw away. Or if you're a sports fan, we've got Twickenham just to the east as well. So I'm lucky to have this behind. This is a sort of, it's called the Beverley. And you might see squirrels. Squirrels actually do run across that. So if you do see a squirrel, yell, and we'll all enjoy that. The inner city wildlife.
Do you have, so where I live, we get a lot of black squirrels. What colour squirrels do you have?
Yeah, well, there's a big debate, isn't it? Because you've got red squirrels, grey squirrels, that kind of stuff. But do you know what? We're more into our foxes. We have foxes that come every evening. So they're quite a popular guest and may or may not have some of the leftover dinner every evening. So that's a bit of a taboo. Do you feed foxes? You know, they're a big part.
They're cute, though. I think they're pretty misunderstood creatures. They're quite...
Your neighbour's happy. That's the key.
Wow. Well, I mean, this feels like it's going to be a really sort of weird podcast. I feel like this could go anywhere. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. But let's take it away from foxes and squirrels and bring it back to you. So take us back to the start. And we know each other, obviously. So I know a little bit. I know a lot about you, but I don't know where life began for a young Tom. So where was home? Where did you grow up?
So born and bred Twickenham and went to school there. I sort of grew up in a sporting family. My granddad was the RFU doctor for 50 years, the England doctor, chief medical delegate for the IRB, that kind of stuff. So a bit like Professor Sid Watkins was to motorsport, he was to rugby. So I kind of grew up around rugby, got picked up from school, went to watch England train, ball boyed at Twickenham, and had just the most wonderful experience around sport and rugby. And my stepfather played cricket. Nothing in the way of motorsport entered my life in any way, shape or form until I was about 10 or 11. And my granddad took me to a race team, Dave Price Racing, actually, which were based in Great Bookham. So my granddad and Dave Price were very good friends. And that was the beginning of the end. So I spent all my young life from that moment trying to get into motorsport. And I always joke saying I spent my whole adulthood trying to get out of it. But here we are. And yeah, that was my upbringing. I was very fortunate to go to boarding school off the back of that and pursued my cricket, played a lot of cricket when I was younger, but always harboured an ambition to be in a go-kart. And it was a difficult conversation because, as we know, sport is quite accessible depending on which sport, motorsport less so. More and more parents know how to get their young children, sons, daughters into football, rugby, cricket, be it through the school or the local teams at the weekends or evenings. But motorsport's a bit harder. And if you have no sort of natural connection with the sport, it can be quite difficult. So trying to convince my parents to take me go-karting was an interesting discussion. It was an annual event surrounding my birthday primarily, and then as I clearly enjoyed it more and more, the sort of push to go-karting was forever there. And it got a bit harder when I went to boarding school and also played cricket as well, because the school really wanted me to play cricket, didn't want me missing all weekend karting. And also the expense, you know, I did have a very fortunate upbringing, but there's a fortunate upbringing and there's the sort of costs that come with motorsport. And we didn't really quite have that, those funds available. So it wasn't until I entered La Filière, the competition, the fast track competition at Silverstone, that I really did start to look at motorsport as a viable option and start to make progress within the sport. I never really did that sort of national two-stroke karting, you know, those big champions of the future competition, Super One, that kind of thing. I didn't do that. I was four-stroke karting in and around in kart clubs and my local kart club here, Sandown Park, which incidentally, Ollie Milroy, Sam Bird, Duncan Tappy, all sort of came through. So there was a little gang of us in Surrey that pioneered that sort of four-stroke route, Formula 6, as it was known back then.
How do you reflect on those, like when you were a kid and you had those options of rugby, cricket, karting? And it's like, I think back to when I was a kid and motorsport was always my thing. My parents, none of my friends were ever interested in that. But then like my dad always wanted me to be a footballer. My mum wanted me to do swimming and badminton. So I did all of those things. But it's like motorsport was always my thing. How much of that early exposure to sport, like if you were an adult now, like if you could go back and kind of decide on the things that were actually what you wanted to be doing versus more kind of what you were exposed to, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I think in the school environment that I was in, it was quite a competitive environment. There was opportunity across the board, whether or not it was music, sport, academia. I was very fortunate in that sense. I was definitely pushed down the academia line. I did not enjoy spending time in the classroom, it's fair to say, but I absolutely loved being on the sports field. I loved all sports apart from football. If you pass me the ball, it'll go through my legs. So don't get me on a football pitch. But rugby and cricket, I really enjoyed that. But it sounds one of those cliche moments. I loved rugby and cricket, but I didn't know that there was motorsport there. You know, obviously I was aware of it, but that first moment that you're exposed to motorsport, if you're a fan, that the sound, the smell, the speed, just everything that goes with it, it was basically like a love affair. It was love at first sight. That there was just no going back from that moment. So yeah, I still continue to, and I love my rugby and my cricket, and I'm a big fan, but nothing competes with the thrill of motorsport for me. And, you know, I'm fortunate to be in and around the sport still. And I still get a real buzz from broadcasting because of the adrenaline buzz that comes around live broadcasting. And, you know, that is not quite the same as driving, but the thrill that I got every time I got in a race car was second to none. You know, it's a magical
feeling. It is funny how motorsport does that to people. I think it's relatively unique. I know people can get get fanatical about football and other sports, but there's something about Formula One and motorsport in general that really captivates people. And you were quite a handy driver by all accounts. What stopped you pursuing that route? Was it just the cash, or you had an injury as well, right? So there were probably multiple things.
Yeah, there were multiple things. As I said, we sort of dabbled in the karting world, but it wasn't until I had a fully funded seat in France to go and race in Formula Renault Campus that my career started to look like it was a viable option. Then I came back and raced for Miguel, for Hayward, who Anthony Davidson the year before, Jenson Button the year before that. So big French manufacturer in Formula Ford. But Formula Ford was booming in the UK. You know, it was such a wonderful feeder series. And anybody who was anyone from international karting or wherever you were in the world, you came over to the UK and you did British Formula Ford and British Formula 3. And it was a wonderful few decades. And I was lucky to sort of piggyback onto the final few years of that. And then I had an undiagnosed spondylolisthesis that I had an accident, and more people kept on going behind the screens when I was having the scans. And to cut a long story short, 20% of the world's population have a spondylolisthesis. Not all 20% will hair into brick walls or tire walls or whatever it is at a rate of knots. So where the bone hadn't formed properly in my lumbar spine, it crumbled away and I didn't have that bone union. So I had to have quite major corrective surgery involving screws, hooks, this and that, bone grafts from my pelvis to firm my whole lumbar spine up. And it took so long to get back fully fit. It wasn't really an option to go back driving. Obviously, I had that burning desire, and it was the only thing that got me through the rehab, was that dream and ambition. But it really, you know, on reflection, wasn't realistic, and that was the end of my career, really, when it comes to driving. But I was fortunate to swap the steering wheel for a microphone, and here we are a few years later.
How was that to kind of come to terms with? Because obviously to say goodbye to that part of your life, but then also to, you know, had you resigned to being like, okay, motorsport's finished completely, but then you've also picked up the microphone and gone into commentary, and now you're kind of, you've gone full circle, and now you're back in the industry just in a very different capacity. Was that always part of the plan once you realised you couldn't carry on behind the wheel?
I'd love to say I dealt with it in my stride with maturity and balance, but that wasn't the case. It was a difficult time for me. I was really emotional.
Of course,
I liken it to a relationship where you're not ready, and the relationship comes to an end, and it was really, really difficult to try and get my head around that. That was my identity. That was my dream. That was everything I'd worked towards for so long, for years and years and years. It was what I thought I was going to be doing. And then to lose that, to see your friends still doing it, the sort of the animosity, the jealousy, the frustration, the why me, just a whole host of emotions made it a really difficult sort of 12 months. And I actually went and got a proper job at Getty Images for a bit, and commuted into London every day up to Camden Town, and realised that was far too much like hard work, and that I needed to sort of reframe what I'd left behind, because what I'd left behind was my friends, was what I knew, was a world that I loved. And once I took that step back, I've never looked back. And, you know, I'm really fortunate to be doing what I'm doing. And I always said that my dream was maybe to get to Formula One. And I've sort of done that. It just wasn't with a steering wheel in my hand. So, yeah, on reflection now, with 41 years on my shoulders, I can look back at it with a smile.
And you started a consultancy business back in 2011, and the premise behind that was to support racing drivers with performance management, mentoring, coaching, and so on. And this is probably where I first became aware of you. And you and I worked together on some driver management years ago. We had Tom and Max Chilton, Ollie Webb, Struan Moore, and importantly, Jamie Chadwick. And I'm really pleased that you're here so we can talk about Jamie Chadwick, because I dine off Jamie Chadwick and the relationship that we had with her way back when. And it's sort of hazy now. You sort of look back and think, did we do that? Did we work with her? What? And we were there at her transition from GT racing with Paul Hollywood through to trying to coach her through some of your knowledge into not being afraid in a single seater car. And I think you and I should take credit for launching Jamie Chadwick's career in a single seater car, because it's true. You were pivotal to that time in her career where it was like, right, do you stick in GTs and go down the endurance route, or do we put you in a single seater and see if we can get you to Formula One? How do you look back at that time?
Yeah, it was a wonderful period in terms of exploring the management side of me. Was about humans, was about putting people first. It's not something that people do an awful lot, but people like to say they do. I'm fascinated in people. I'm fascinated in the human underneath the performer, and doing it for the right reasons, not trying to earn money out of people, but actually having that sort of care and that responsibility and trying to get people to develop and flourish. And with Jamie, you had that really rough diamond in the sense that she was so quick, but she didn't really know what she knew. And it was right at the beginning of what's been a really exciting journey for her, and a journey that's still continuing. And to be able to sort of have those discussions and to try and help her understand not just what she was doing in a race car, but who she was. We're so fixated on the technical and tactical skill sets, the performer, but we rarely focus on the human element. And actually, in order for the performer to be able to be the best that they want to be on the biggest days of their life and deliver on those tech and tax skills. They need to have a really good understanding of self and that sort of toolkit that goes with them in order to be able to deliver. And with Jamie, we were well on the way to sort of talking about that. And, you know, I hope she took some of it on board because her career has really been in the limelight. She's always the one that people look at. She's always under scrutiny. Every single session, every failure, every success is almost criticized. And so it's really difficult. And, you know, we do speak occasionally and I've sort of reconnected with her because she's out in the States at the moment and we're doing some Indy Next stuff on Sky Sports F1. It was lovely to speak to her recently. But, you know, she has such a difficult time of it, I think. And if you speak to athletes, whatever it is, whether or not it's Formula One or competing at the top level in rugby cricket or at the Olympics, one of the things that top athletes always say is, I wish I'd enjoyed it a bit more. And it's actually something that sounds quite strange, but when you're under all the pressure and you're in the pressure cooker that Jamie's in, it's quite hard sometimes to actually sit back and enjoy it all.
What do you, I guess both of you, as you both work with Jamie, what do you make of the kind of, well, and how much do you think it was a decision necessary to go to the States and go to Indy Next instead of Formula 3 and going through that more European pyramid? How much of that do you think was decision? Because obviously you need a lot of money to, I'm not sure how much you need to bring to the table in Indy Next, but I know in F2 and F3, it's in the millions every year. So what do you make of that choice to kind of go down that route instead? We've seen a few F2 drivers obviously make the move, Callum Ilott, Christian Lundgaard, Marcus Armstrong, you know, it seems like it's becoming a more common thing for European drivers to go to the States.
Yeah, I think so. There's a different sponsorship model available to you if you're a competitor in the States. So for example, for Jamie, DHL are already a partner within the Andretti stable. They're on the Grosjean car and they've been drawn back into Indy Next because Jamie is very marketable, and that's a wonderful platform for both of them. I don't think you always get that platform in Formula One. So you don't get partners from Formula One teams dropping down into Formula Two and taking drivers forward like you did in the 80s, 90s, for example. You know, you had Marlboro, you had, you know, loads of different brands that would drop down and take drivers forward. You don't get that now. I still think there is that opportunity in America. Tim is actually the expert on the commercial side of things, so he probably has a much more informed take on it than I do. But that's, you know, my snippet on it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, the Americans are brilliant at sponsorship. They often put us to shame. You know, you look at the amount of brands there are in NASCAR and IndyCar, and big brands. They really know how to leverage the assets and sweat the assets that they get. And for Jamie, you know, fair play to her. I would love to know the backstory about the reasons for going to the States. You know, whether it is purely financial reasons, which I don't know. I mean, we know her parents, Tom, and they do have money. They don't have mega money, so perhaps the F2, F3, you know, maybe it was out of reach. But I don't think it's a bad move for her. You know, she can go out there and hopefully she does well. She had a bit of bad luck in the first race, didn't she? It didn't go quite according to plan, but you know, I hope things work out for her out there, and I hope she comes back to Europe and races at a high level here, because you know, she is the standout performer in women's racing. Some would argue, not all. You know, there are others out there, but she's certainly the most marketable. So it'd be very interesting to follow what happens with her over the coming years. But and all the best to her. Now, Tom, you've covered all sorts of motorsport series. You've done F1 TV, Sky Sports with IndyCar. Do you have a favourite? Is there one that particularly stands out to you that you enjoy doing?
I really enjoy the IndyCar, and that's something that I've been fortunate enough to work on for years now, even when it was at BT and transitioned to Sky. The IndyCar for me is something I grew up watching. It's a wonderful championship that's very, very accessible and just caters for what I want out of sport, which is I love the personalities. You know, I'm people first, so you get to really see the personalities in IndyCar. You don't get the same faces on the top step of the podium. You know, Will Power last year, for example, 17 races, only won one race and won the championship, you know. So it's a very, very different vehicle in terms of the exposure that you get all the way through the grid. And I love the way the Americans activate their brands and the sort of show that they put around sport. Now, I know that's not for everyone, but I watch the Super Bowl. I love NFL. I love the American sport, and I think they do it so, so well. So what really gets the hair on the back of my neck tingling? IndyCar, because when you're doing the broadcast, when you're building up to it, you have the invocation, you have the most famous words in motorsport, and you know everything that happens before the races, I think is wonderful. And then in the race, it's impossible to pick who's going to win. I mean, it is impossible, and I think that's a wonderful.
Well, I mean, look at the year that it was just after I stopped managing Max. And he was what, fourth with a few laps to go. And I was like, oh, he's going to bloody win this. And he didn't, but he came incredibly close. And, you know, and let's be honest, Max was, you know, more often than not towards the middle or the back of the grid. So like you say, you just never know, do you? Don't know. It's far less predictable than Formula One.
The examples are just endless. Dan Weldon's last Indy 500 win when Hildebrand fenced it on turn four. You know, you look back at
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This last year when McLaughlin led every lap basically, and then Newgarden did him on the final corner and just crossed the line. You look at St. Pete just a couple of weeks ago where so many drivers had a turn at leading that race and couldn't win it. So yeah, I love IndyCar. I think it's awesome.
I do wish I'd started watching it sooner, because I've only started in the last kind of couple of seasons. I'll try and watch the highlights where I can, because I think there's some really exciting drivers. I think it's a championship that's really underrated in the... I know we were talking earlier this year about the whole super license points and Colton Herter, and it's like you look at the quality of driver on show at IndyCar, and the fact that that's offered, you know, for some positions, less super license points for the same position in Formula 3 is pretty mad. Like, how have you seen IndyCar grow? Obviously, you said you've been watching it, most of your life, especially, you know, in Europe. I feel like what are the numbers doing? Has it been a, you know, big increase in audience, or is it kind of, and is it getting helped by, I guess, that Drive to Survive effect that I think is bringing a lot more people into the broader motorsport pool generally?
Yeah, so our viewing figures for the 500 last year were more than Sky's viewing figures for the final day of the US Open Golf. So that gives you an indication as to how much that audience is growing. We have more viewers last year than we've ever had, and some of the demographics, that the female audience, the younger audience, we really grew that last year at Sky. And so Sky really happy, IndyCar really happy. We have a wonderful relationship with NBC as well. And I think that the show is undeniable. It's starting to grow again. We know the politics behind the split. So I used to watch the cart days, you know, Dario and everyone fighting it out, Paul Tracy and what wonderful days they were with Zanardi and Damata and so forth. But the fallout then, the IRL split and everything that happened, it was a difficult few decades. But if you look at what Penske's done over the last few years, how much they're investing in the marketing budget this year, the fact that Formula One is growing, like you said, in the States, what Formula One has done in the States off the back of Drive to Survive is actually only serving to boost IndyCar as well. It's not in competition. Formula One is there just a couple of times a year. And what that does is engage that young audience to Formula Racing, and then they go and find their own substitute that they can support and focus on all year round, and that's IndyCar. So it's a wonderful success, the Formula One story in America, and that's boosting it. And I honestly believe with Roger Penske now at the helm and that Penske Corporation with what they're doing, it's really starting to grow.
Yeah, Penske is beast of an organisation, isn't it? And not just IndyCar, but you know, you look at IMSA and stuff like that, which they're involved with. So really starting to do some great things out there. Now, let's turn our attention to Formula One. It's an interesting era at the moment. There's a lot of rumours going around about lots of different things. What's the future for Lewis Hamilton? Is there going to be a London City Grand Prix of some description? Have you got any inside skinny? Are we going to see Formula One cars tearing it up around Westminster?
They'd have to be ULEZ compliant. So I'm not bringing politics into it. That's a story that just hasn't gone away. And I'm sure Liberty would love to crack that nut, so to speak. They've really done wonders in the States. Will there ever be a Grand Prix in London? Yeah, it's something we'd all love to see. Whether or not it's possible, I just don't know. And there would be a lot of red tape and a lot of barriers to sort of hop through. And the sort of pathway from discussion to actually delivering would be
a squirrel.
Squirrel. Squirrel, yes. Sorry, squirrel. Actually, from here, it looked like a little monkey. It's a bloody big squirrel.
There you go.
Sorry, Tom. I'm like, carry on. Squirrel, you
know, we need a sound effect for squirrel. I don't know what I've got here. Hold on.
Is that Glock?
There's got to be something. Anyway, carry on.
I think we're a million miles off right now, still. But
I mean, that track map that they put out, it's got a double Singapore sling. Like, it's like left, right, left, right, left, right. I don't know. I mean, I'm from like the East End. Like, my family's all from the East End, and it'd be around Docklands where they're suggesting. And it's just like, I don't know. I don't think I want it. I'll be honest. I don't think I want it. You see this exodus of F1 to move into walled street circuits, and I understand it. You know, you're putting it in front of more kind of eyeballs that are potentially not invested. You know, Silverstone's in the middle of nowhere. I get there's limitations around that, but I don't know. I don't think, for me, the focus should be on expanding the sport into territories that isn't in. Like, I mean, you look at, you know, areas like Indonesia, India, the Philippines. Like, there's such a massive potential market in terms of just numbers of people who are invested. And I don't know, there's still no Grand Prix in Africa yet. It sounds like Kyle Army, it was maybe going to happen, maybe it's not now. I'm just not convinced that I didn't like what I saw, I'll be honest.
You can't fall into the trap of it being an event, which, you know, not taking anything away from Miami, it's more of an event for me than it was a spectacle. I think if you're going to really engage the motorsport fan, it has to be a spectacle. Look at Nashville last year, or the last 2 years in America with IndyCar, where they've got them racing over the bridge. And it's big. It's like six-lane freeway where they're like coming through a kink trying to break that. You know, it's a huge spectacle. I mean, don't get me wrong, it was absolute chaos. And there was probably about seven cars written off. It was the race where Ericsson went in the air and still won it. But you need, for me, you need that spectacle. It can't just be a procession, an event. It has to, the track has to bring the cars to life. If it doesn't, then it's just a massive PR exercise. And, you know, I'm one foot in, let's get some great racing going, you know.
And that's where I just feel like I don't know where they would build a track that could actually work sustainably in London, one of the busiest cities in the world, like to not just be that. I feel like the Formula E track at the XL, you know, it hasn't gone... I think it's definitely one of the weaker tracks on the calendar for me when you compare to some of the other places. I mean, again, when I was in Marrakesh, I went past, I could see all the Formula E branding for the track there. Like, I don't know. I'm not convinced they could make it more than just a track that they've just shoehorned in.
Yeah, the last track, the Cape Town track, I think they're doing 156 miles an hour. I was talking to one or two of the drivers, which, you know, they're shifting. And that Durban track, was it Durban there in? No, Cape Town, sorry.
Cape Town.
That track was awesome. And the Hyderabad circuit as well. The circuit in India was cool. And yeah, you've hit the nail on the head, Tom. I think that the London event is a wonderful event and so many people say that. But the track is a bit fiddly, which doesn't add to the spectacle.
No, it would just be an exercise in like, oh, look at an F1 car going in front of that old building. You know, isn't that spectacular? And you know, dodging potholes.
There's the Wembley Arch.
But, you know, yeah. Woo, look at that. Oh, and there's an F1 car. But yeah, I don't know. Let's see. Well, what do you think about the current era of Formula One then? Are you a fan? Do you like the current cars as they're designed to be, you know, traveling a little bit closer together and all the new bits and pieces or lack of bits and pieces on the car? Do you like the racing?
I think I like the fact that the cars are fast and that they really challenge the drivers and they're really quick. I mean, the amount of load they've got on them and the high speed corners, phenomenal, maybe almost too much grip. For me, that's a step forward compared to where we are. I'm still in love with two decades ago, the V10s, the smaller cars, and just the speed elements and the sort of they were like red arrows, weren't they? You know, it just looked phenomenal when you watched it. The sound, that for me would be my dream. And I don't want to be one of those people that's getting old that starts every sentence, well, in my day, you know. But it's definitely, I think they're too big, they're too heavy, but I love the speed aspect of them. And I think we kind of lost that for a little bit, especially when we were taking away, you know, the aero loading and also the, you know, the fact that the Pirelli tyres needed to be sort of babysat all the way around the Grand Prix. I mean, we were just hopelessly slow. You know, some circuits, they were sort of, it was almost GP2 pole time, wasn't it? Was average race pace. So
see, I think there is maybe a solution that, because I saw Karun Chandhok talking about this on Twitter and talking about how, you know, we saw it last year with Seb when he brought out his old Williams, his old Mansell Williams, run on 100% bioethanol. You know, these F1 cars with the hybrid, you know, battery technology in these cars, it's adding a good amount of weight. I don't think these cars are going to get any smaller because I think safety and fair enough, you can have a crash like Mick Schumacher had at Saudi Arabia last year and walk out of a car what Joe had last year. I think that's in part credit because just to how physically big these cars are. But if you can make them lighter, and maybe F1, you know, should go down the fully like, right, we're going to ditch the battery, but then go down fully like sustainable fuel. You've got these other motorsports, LMP, I think in Indy it's bioethanol already, right? So it's like, could F1 make its own sustainable route?
We're on 100% renewable fuel this year in IndyCar already. And the tyres are made from Wyoli, which, have we heard of Wyoli?
I have not heard of Wyoli.
There you go. Nope. You've not been watching Gardeners Weekly, which Wyoli is a plant-based shrub grown only in Arizona. So the alternate tyre on the street circuits is now the Wyoli tyre, which is derived from this plant-based material. So that's their push to sustainability. But yeah, going back to it, IndyCar is 100% renewable fuel. And Karen made the, I think it was he that made the point that you've sort of got the hypercars doing that sort of hybrid stuff, the WEC cars, IMSA, that kind of thing. And then you've got Formula E doing electric, and Formula One can go and find its own USP, which could be sort of renewable fuels and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm sort of in, I've got one foot in both camps. I love the modernization of Formula One and the attempt to try and find, you know, greener ways of running. I'm warming up to Formula E every car iteration. I warm to it a little bit more, but I do miss, you know, when you talk about the old days, my first race was 2005 in Spa. And I feel sorry for people that never went to one of these races, you know, in that era or beyond before it all got quiet. But the noise of 20 odd cars on the starting grid in 2005 was absolutely incredible. And we'll never experience that again unless you go to a historic or something like that. But it was so spine tingling, and that has definitely gone. Like, I go to a race now and I can be stood by the track having a relatively normal level conversation with someone without having to pull out earplugs. You know, back then, you just forget it. I mean, you couldn't hear anything anywhere.
You could feel it it was a strange feeling. And also the fuel made your eyes water. So it was like cutting up onions. Yeah. You'd be stood in a garage and you were sort of like, woo, like falling.
I had that. When I first went to work out in the Middle East, I went to the drag strip at Yas Marina Circuit and watched the Top Fuel dragsters. Nobody told me that they run off basically poison. And when they disappear down the quarter mile and they spit out all these fumes, I was like, I'm blind. I've been pepper sprayed, rape sprayed. Like, what the hell is this? It's the most painful thing I've ever experienced in my eye. But anyway, we digress again. Who would be Tom Gaymore if you could choose your ultimate lineup in Formula One? Two drivers, one team principal. You're the boss. You're the money man. Who do you bring in?
Two drivers, one team boss.
Any driver, any era. You don't have to go modern day.
So I'd bring in the captain, Roger Penske.
Nice.
Just because I think, and you know, Zach Brown talks about this. He's a current team, you know, boss, and you know, he looks up to Roger. So I'll bring in Roger Penske, and I would go for Montoya, because I feel that I loved his raw approach, his natural speed. He was difficult to manage. He was unpredictable. So I absolutely loved, you know, what he brings or brought to the table. And then it's got to be a young driver. So who do I think is great at the moment? You know, I think I love Lando. I think Lando's doing a fantastic job. I'd probably go for Charles Leclerc, because he deserves a break. And obviously with the captain in charge, with me in the back of the garage and with Montoya there, that's going to be a formidable lineup. It'd be just the break that Charles Leclerc was looking for.
It's a good lineup. Tomo, what would you go for?
I would go for... you know, Montoya was like one of my favorite drivers growing up. If we can pick a driver, I think like 2003 to 2005, Kimi Raikkonen would just be like, that was Kimi just driving that McLaren on rails. And that was one of my earlier kind of F1 memories, as well, him in that car. Oh yeah, he was incredible. And like, I guess team principal, and maybe I'm not overly convinced that he hasn't had anything to do with McLaren's current struggles, but obviously Andreas Seidel, I've got a lot of time for Andreas.
Yeah.
And he's kind of, you know, been moved to Alfa Romeo Sauber to set it up for Audi. I've got a lot of time for Seidel. I think he's a good level head at the top of that team.
I agree. I think that's
And then I think the professor, Alan Prost, why not? For me, he's chronically underrated as one of the greatest.
I love that dynamic. Kimi, and then the professor. That'd be an interesting debrief.
It would.
Who are you going for?
Come on, Tim.
I'd go for pure entertainment value. So I'd go Günther Steiner,
classic marketing swear, man.
Just to swear at everybody. Then I'd probably go, only because I was reading about this guy the other day, and I don't know why, but it's come up in a couple of conversations I've had about how good he was and how sadly, outside of, you know, the hardcore fan, forgotten he was. Mike Hawthorne. Absolute legend, you know, died way too early. I think 28 years old, but was an absolute, you know, one of the original brilliant drivers. And then I'd probably put someone completely batty with him as well, who, you know, they could go and get drunk together, like a, I don't know, who's kind of wild and crazy. Kimmy, I'd probably go Kimmy as well, but Kimmy with Hawthorne, and they just go and get leathered together and drink loads of vodka, and Günther would swear at them. I think that'd be a good combo. Now, Tom, you've had a very wide and varied career. There's a lot of people now with the rise of Formula One who are desperate to get into the sport. They will tread over each other to try and find a way to get into Formula One or motorsport more widely. What advice can you give to people now that you've been in the industry for 20 years or plus? What can people do to get their foot in the door? Because there are so many people trying.
Yeah, I think it's a question that I get asked a lot, and I know it's a question that you get asked a lot. For me, it boils down to that burning desire. You need to be sure that it's for you. It's a very it's a difficult industry. It's almost a vocation. So you never switch off, and whether or not you're working in the factory, you're working on the race team, the hours that you work are phenomenal, and you have the enforced summer break now to almost manage that. You know, it's very much a vocation. So be sure that it's something that you want to do, because there will be many highs and many lows, and you've got to try and navigate through those. A lot of the lows are at the beginning, because the doors that you need to open are few and far between. So therefore, there's a lot of people pulling outside those doors, and you need a bit of luck. And it's a bit like the slogan in motorsport: would you rather be good or would you rather be lucky? And everyone says lucky. And I think that is something that you've got to be patient around. And as well as have that endeavor, that burning passion, have that patience as well, because you might not enter the sport where you think you're going to enter the sport. You might not end up doing what you think you're going to end up doing. And, you know, I'm a case study for that. I entered the sport very late. I did something I didn't think I would end up doing. I'm now talking about it instead of doing it. It's a weird and wonderful world. There's so much opportunity out there. So go and explore the opportunity as well. So if you want to be a broadcaster, it's very hard sometimes, and you need the opportunities to open up. So you might have you might be a keep fit guru. Go and get your qualifications, enter the sport as somebody that can work with the drivers and work with the teams and get that nutrition and hydration. Then you network in the paddocks, you speak to different people, you might do a vlog, you might be in front of a camera, it's just the beginning for you. And it's a weird and wonderful way, the world, the way it pans out and the journeys that we end up. It's important to have an idea of the direction, but don't fixate on the road, because there's so many different lanes and tributaries that you can push out and explore. So that would be my sort of airy fairy advice, if you like, but just keep banging that drum.
Very wise words. Now, Tomo, we're going to have to go straight into our final three, because unbelievably, we've whizzed through 46 minutes and 30 seconds. So why don't you kick off with the first of the final three this week?
Of course. So, Tom, what has got you most excited at the moment, just in life generally?
Most excited. Do you know what? I'm really excited about IndyCar. As I said, we're growing it. We started off with a tiny, tiny team. Neil Wooding, who's the associate producer that is the the man behind the scenes that just makes everything work. He's got a magic wand at Sky Sports, and he works across Formula One and IndyCar. So think how busy he is. But what we're doing with the support of Billy at the top is wonderful. We've had wonderful conversations with IndyCar. So I'm really excited to see where we can take that. We had our studio last year, which went down really, really well. We're going to try and build on that this year and just keep bringing IndyCar to the audience and growing the UK audience here, because it's, I always say, it's a bit like, you know, we go to church every Sunday night. It's the same people. We're growing. There's lots of enthusiasm. Everyone gets on. And so that's what's making me excited at the moment.
Very good. Number two, how much of your success do you put down to luck and right place, right time? And how much do you put down to downright hard work and graft?
Yeah, well, they always say, talent isn't everything. So you've got to have that endeavor and that sort of passion and burning desire that I had when I was driving has served me really well with a lot of other things that I do in life. Sometimes it's actually your greatest Achilles heel as well, when you look at a balance, when you look at well-being, when you look at reflection. So I think for me, you definitely need luck. Without luck, you really are up a stream without a paddle. But you need that work base. You know, you make your own luck.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And finally, Tom, what are you scared of?
Yeah, good. I'm scared of heights. Don't like flying either. I wouldn't get out of an aeroplane if it was working, so I wouldn't go...
That's not the idea, really, is it, to get out of the airplane while it's flying, to be fair? Yeah.
So I'd probably say, yeah, one of those.
Okay, very good. Well, listen, Tom, it's great to be connected again. I look forward to seeing you in 3D and going for a beer and catching up properly. But thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck with your future endeavours. Best of luck with the IndyCar stuff and preaching the IndyCar dream over here. It's a brilliant series, and hopefully the audience does continue to grow. Until next time, thanks for joining us on the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth _, Instagram at Motormouth _official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app, where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumours quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.